Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I'm recording this Tuesday, September 15th, exactly 7 weeks from what we usually call Election Day. This year we call the day the polls close. Too many elections, we're told, are the most important of our lifetimes, but this one probably is. To see what things felt like 3.5 years ago, the week Trump took office, here's my January 28th, 2017 conversation with Mark Hertzgaard, environmental correspondent of The Nation and executive director of Covering Climate Now, Richard Eskow of The Zero Hour on radio and TV, and poet Drew Dellinger of Planetize the Movement. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Freeform. I went on a hiatus from new interviews almost 2 years ago, and I broke that hiatus 2 weeks ago with a show of reflections on the election and the path forward. And I couldn't resist again this week, following the inauguration of Donald Trump and the millions around the U.S. and the globe who marched yesterday. I'll be joined today by Drew Dellinger, Richard Eskow, and Mark Hertzgaard, three writers who've joined me over the years and who each have a valuable perspective on politics and life in these challenging times. I only decided to do this 2 days ago, and given the power and the importance of the marches on Saturday, I, of course, reached out to a number of women, but none were able to join us, so it's me and three guys. I apologize, but that's the way we're going to have to roll today. Prior to the last few weeks, I've been digging into the archives of over 15 years to stream one of the best of my earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn on Saturday and Sunday nights. And then podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. And on Freeform, we've always explored the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I believe have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work based on the fact that I believe we can do better and I want to find out how. So first, I want to give you some thoughts about the inauguration and the marches. I did not watch the inauguration, though I caught a few clips on TV and online. No big surprises, except if it remains a surprise that he keeps being Donald Trump and doesn't change himself into President Donald Trump. American carnage and that whole tone cribbed from his rally speeches. Perhaps the most alarming and noted thing was his declaration of only America first, America first. And it strikes me this is a projection on Trump's part. He's now made the country as narcissistic as he is, because we know when he says that, what he really means is me first, me first. And now, since he represents the country, he thinks the country feels that way as well. Let's move to the marches. I marched in Los Angeles. My guests, two of them marched in Washington and one in Oakland. And I must say, I expected there to be a big response. I expected there to be a positive response, believe it or not. But they exceeded my experience, certainly exceeded my expectations. Some of the numbers, and many of you may be aware of this, but estimates in Los Angeles go as high as 750,000. There was a police estimate quoted in Time magazine of 500,000. The numbers I pulled off of Ryan Grimm has an article up at Huffington Post collecting the numbers, and so these are from that. But all of them have some attribution from a newspaper or radio television station, some sort of a report. But 680,000 in D.C., 400,000 in New York, 250,000 in Chicago, 175,000 in Boston, which is notable because Boston is a heck of a lot smaller city than the other ones I've mentioned so far, 130,000 in Seattle, 100,000 in Denver, Portland, San Francisco, Minneapolis, 75 to 100,000 in Madison, Wisconsin. Wisconsin, one of the states crucial to Trump's electoral victory, 85,000 in Oakland, 60,000 in Atlanta. I'm going to look at two more that were crucial states. Raleigh, North Carolina, had 30,000. And 25,000 in Charlotte, North Carolina, again, a crucial state in Trump's electoral toll. Let's see here. There were also significant marches in Michigan and in Pennsylvania, another couple of the crucial states. In Los Angeles, what was most impressive to me was, A, the size it blew everyone's mind, but also the diversity. The marchers were as diverse as this city. The feeling, the mood, and this is what is interesting, it seems to me, was positive, enthusiastic. And though some of the statements on the signs certainly expressed anger, I didn't feel it among the people or the speakers that I heard. And that's an interesting note. I will also say, and I'll ask for some contributions from my guests later, but I thought these were the most creative demonstration signs I've ever seen, and I've been in demonstrations since the late 60s, and I'm not sure why that is. The three women I was marching with thought it might be because this was a march organized by women. I think it had to do with two other things. One, social media has gotten people more attuned to being short and witty. They do it on their headlines, on their Facebook posts. They do it on their tweets or something, or they just digest a lot more of it. So I think that may be part of it. Also, L.A. has a lot of creative people, but that wouldn't explain. They had creative people when they were protesting the Iraq War, too. I think one other thing is that because it had no single issue, you could basically express on a wide range, and that left people to be really creative. Some of the most creative I saw, "We shall overcome," OVRCOMB, which I thought was very clever. "Make America think again. Think outside my box. Did you remember to set your clocks back 60 years last night? Grab him by the midterms. And one that was really prescient, "Donald J. Trump will lie about this." And of course, the next day he did, in terms of crowds and so on and so on. Another thing that was significant in L.A. was when the politicians got up to speak, every single one of them, Mayor Garcetti, City Attorney Feuer, assembly people, supervisors, they all universally stated their defiance for the views and likely actions of Trump and the administration. I think we all have to agree that that has not always been the case in demonstrations, and it really shows the outlier status of Los Angeles and California from what's going to be going on in the Capitol and White House over the next few years. One question that I wish a speaker had asked was, for how many was this their first demonstration or march? And if not their first, how long had it been since their last one? There was a quote in today's one of the articles in today's LA Times. Sheila Thunbo said, "I will help sustain this energy because he stands against everything America is for, in my opinion." And she shared that it was her first protest since she'd marched against the Vietnam War as a college student. I am willing to bet there were many in the crowd that had not marched since anti-Vietnam marches or maybe anti-Iraq war marches. And many, I'm guessing a huge percentage, that it might have been the first demonstration they'd ever been in. Certainly, the children who surrounded me, because this was a very family-friendly march, and there were husbands, wives, children, as I say, of all races and ethnicities, all over the place in the LA march. A couple of notes from some of the folks on the podium, not here, but in Boston, Elizabeth Warren. "We can whimper, we can whine, or we can fight back. Me, I'm going to fight back." We know she is. And Michael Moore, I thought, did a really good job, because what he did was he made two statements that I think are really powerful and necessary. One was, "The old guard of the Democratic Party has to go. We need new leadership." And I think that is very clear after this election, whether one looks just at the presidency or on down through the Senate, the House, and state legislatures. He also encouraged marchers to run for office and to call their representatives every single day to let them know how you feel, and went so far as to urge the crowds to repeat the Capital switchboard number, 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121, until they'd memorized it. I think that's a lot where this place has to go. A couple of other thoughts. This was started by one woman who posted to her Facebook page, election night, I believe, why don't women, she sent it, I think, to 40 people. Why don't women have a march, or we should have a march right after the inauguration? And then it grew from that to what it turned out to be 66 countries yesterday, over 600 cities in the U.S. This shows the power of social media and the power of the people. One last note before I bring in my guests. I saw Cokie Roberts the night before on, I'm not sure what show, I'm not sure what network she's with right now, I'm sorry, but she criticized the march prior to their taking place because they didn't have clear demands. She felt that they should have a clear demand. My sense is that would be a criticism in 6 months, maybe. But right now, what this was a statement that said, we are here. We are not resigned to this election. We are not going to take this sitting down. We are here. We're responding. And depends what he acts on. Depends what he chooses to act on. We are ready. Courage Campaign, in their phone call very soon after the election, said basically what they were attempting to do with Courageous Resistance in the state of California was to have many thousands to millions of people willing and ready to be mobilized at any moment when that is necessary, when a particular bill comes up, when a particular action is being talked about. And I think that is what we're doing, is we are getting millions of citizens to re-enroll in activism. I will also talk with my guest later about a notion I talked about 2 weeks ago and which has been rolling around in my mind for months and then really crystallized with the election, which is this notion of 60s 2.0, the best of the 60s, meshed with modern technology in a cross-generational, cross-issue rebirth of activism in this country. And I think to some extent that's what yesterday was. And as I said, I saw many quotes in the papers and in people I spoke with where it was, I haven't done this since the 60s. I haven't seen this since the 60s. This is going to be an interesting time as we move forward. Okay, I'm going to bring in my guest now. Richard R.J. Esko is a writer. He's host of the syndicated radio show The Zero Hour and formerly one of Bernie Sanders' writers during his presidential campaign. Welcome again to Freeform, Richard.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Okay. And Drew Dellinger, Ph.D., is a speaker, poet, writer, teacher. He's founder of Planetize the Movement, and he's the author of the award-winning poetry collection Love Letter to the Milky Way, and he has an upcoming book, Martin Luther King, Ecological Thinker Toward a Cosmology of Connection. Hello, Drew.
Hey, Terrence and Richard. Great to be with you.
Okay.
And you too.
Okay. Thank you, Drew. And Mark Hertzgard, veteran journalist, author, the investigative editor of The Nation, America's oldest weekly magazine. He's also the author of 7 books, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, and one that I think people will be referring to, during the term of Donald Trump, On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
Very good to be here, Terrence.
Okay. So my first question, and let's do it in the order I introduced you, just for simplicity's sake. Where did each of you participate in the march Saturday? And some initial thoughts about what happened and what it might mean. Richard Esko.
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. My first demonstration, by the way, was in 1969. I felt there was the moratorium, the March on Washington, and I felt there was a strong similarity of energy there. I was also at the inauguration the day before and the counter-protests, and there was something to the theory of collective energy, because even though the weather was just as gloomy and so on, there was the minute I walked out the door in Washington, I could feel a difference. And once I got to the demonstration, I felt that there was humor, there was warmth, there was solidarity in the human sense of the word, of people feeling like one community, as well as political solidarity. It exceeded all my expectations. Some of the demonstrations the day before were very nice too, but there was something about the size and the nature of this event that I thought was truly inspiring.
Okay. Drew Dellinger.
Yeah, I was in Oakland, and I was, like you've been saying, just overwhelmed by the massive turnout and the energy of the people. I mean, I've been at a lot of demonstrations and marches in Oakland, and I haven't seen anything remotely like that. I mean, the closest thing in terms of size would be a march during what was called the general strike during Occupy Oakland. And in that instance, a veteran named Scott Olson had just been almost killed in the streets during a protest, and then when a tear gas canister was fired directly at his head and cracked his skull. And so there was this massive response. And then, you know, I think back to the civil rights movement, you know, and the Selma campaign and the whole Selma to Montgomery march and that victorious eventually voting rights campaign that emerged from, you know, the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson. So when the people have been injured, when there's been an injury to the people, that's when we see often these overwhelming responses. And I think the turnout yesterday all over the nation, all over the world in huge numbers, shows us that there's been an injury to the people. There's a way in which many people, communities, and our collective psyches were feeling injured from the racism, the hatred, the bigotry of the campaign. And many of us were hoping that there was going to be an overwhelming response on repudiating that kind of hatred and bigotry and division on November 8th. But it turned out that the overwhelming response came yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Mark Hertzgard. I believe you were also in Washington, and some of your response.
Yes, I was in Washington covering the protest march for the Nation magazine, and I must say that does give me one advantage over pretty much all of the people who were commenting on it on CNN and CBS and all over the weekend. I was actually at the rally that we were supposed to be covering. And I would say, having covered many protest marches and rallies over the years, that this was by far the biggest. In fact, I think it was very possibly the Washington protest march alone. We saw very possibly the single largest political demonstration in United States history in Washington on Saturday. And if you combine the Washington event with Los Angeles, where you told me, Terrence, that the police have been saying 500,000 demonstrators in Los Angeles and in New York and Chicago and all the other cities. Saturday was certainly, without question, the largest day of political protest in United States history. And that deserves fame, because you're not hearing that coming out of the mainstream media. There is recognition, I think, that the numbers were very large, but the magnitude of it is very, very striking. That's the first point. And then second, it's not just that the opposition to Trump rather is very big. It's also that it is fighting back and defiant from the very first day in office. This is not a repeat of George W. Bush's presidency, for example, where it took a while for the protests against the president to take form. This was the very first day. In fact, some of the one of the most memorable chants that I heard yesterday in Washington went, "We're not going away. Welcome to your first day. We're not going away. Welcome to your first day." So what that tells me is that you know, Donald Trump is going to have people in his face, not just in opposition, but in his face as he goes forward, and if he does, in fact, try to implement the agenda that he promised in the campaign, he has a real fight on his hands.
Okay. I agree with all of what you said. I think the one thing that is interesting, and I assume you all found it interesting as well, was that as angry as we are, as upset as we are, as frustrated as we are, rightly so, the feeling was very different. I go back to Vietnam, anti-Vietnam protests, and probably starting a couple of years before you, Richard, because I'm probably a little bit older. But the positive feeling, almost joy and enthusiasm that was in the crowd. What do people make of that? Who wants to go?
Well, I guess I'll go first. This is Richard.
Yeah.
You probably are a couple years older because I was 15 and intoxicated in 1969. But, I think a lot of it has to do with the affirmation that community creates, the sense that, people may – I think people reacted to the Trump election with a sense of despair and isolation that is best healed by community, by coming together. And social media can help, but coming together in real space, in physical space, and seeing one another, I think was to me it felt like a homecoming, a sense of people in exile being allowed to return to their native land or to go to it for the first time, where they were not outsiders, they were not strangers. Yes, this is my country, these are my people of all kinds, all races, all ethnicities, genders, but the sense that there was a returning home and that enormous sense of welcome and togetherness and a sense that we belong together and we can continue to act in the future together. That was the optimistic note, too.
I believe so. My wife actually, this may have been her first political protest. And she shared in her Facebook post how, very much to what you just said, Richard, she said, when I experienced the election, I felt alone. And she said, now I feel I know where I belong. And that's powerful stuff. And I think there are millions like her. Drew or Mark, anything you want to say about the feeling of optimism in the face, not just in the face of the Trump administration, but in the anger, frustration, et cetera, that we all know people feel at the same time?
Yeah, go ahead, Drew. This is Drew.
Okay, Drew, and then it sounds like you want to chime in too, so Mark, you'll follow Drew. Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, well, I think, joy is very important. Humor is very important. And for folks who've been, I hear what you're saying about the different tenor that you've experienced, but I think you know that there's often a lot of joy and art and celebration in some of our mass mobilizations and our protests and our demonstrations. And I think it's very important, the role that the arts play, the role that humor plays. You know, we have to do prefigurative politics and we have to embody the world that we're seeking to build as we're creating it. And so I think the art and the humor are very much a part of that. I do think I would warn just a tiny bit about making too much of a strict division between the way police react to huge marches that are billed as the Women's March and the way they react to black and brown communities who are protesting police violence. So I think it's fantastic that there was no violence or property destruction or whatever that might have taken away from the message of the march. But I don't want to see a strict division between this is a good protest, this is a good bad protest, when in fact it's state power and the militarized police that often determine the outcome of how these demonstrations in the streets go. But anyone who's been in the streets, like being in Seattle in 1999 or any of the other times I've been in the streets, when you're marching through the streets with a crowd of people and you can feel the energy and see the art and hear the music and the drumming and the chant, it's really something that has to be experienced to fully understand. And that kind of joy and that kind of feeling of exhilaration, and we really can envision a different world together, I think is something very powerful. And I don't think it's coincidental that we've seen this in the wake of Occupy, in the wake of the movement for Black Lives, some of the most important protest movements, particularly the movement for Black Lives, the most important action for racial justice in 50 years in this country. So I think there's a way in which people are catching on. There's a normalization of protest and the sense that we need protest and demonstration and action to build the kind of world we want.
Right, and what I hear you saying is not merely so that we have, you know, we're showing them our power and so on, but partly just so we know where our community is, and we get we take sustenance and energy from that, and if we don't do it, we miss out on that. Mark.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a gathering of the tribe. That's what I hear a lot of people saying here. And that was certainly the feeling that I observed in Washington, D.C. I think part of that, and I also observed the sense of fun, Terrence, that you mentioned.
Yeah.
I've covered a lot of protests over a lot of years. And I've never seen people having fun, just fun, at a protest rally like I did Saturday in Washington, D.C. Lots of humor, much more than any political protest that I can recall, and a lot of it being directed directly at Trump. CNN afterwards yesterday, of course, had some of their right-wing pundits on complaining about how this was supposed to be a women's march, and it wasn't really a women's march because some women were not invited. Well, it is true that this began as a women's march, but it very definitely became an anti-Trump march more generally. And that tribe did coalesce. And a lot of them, especially the younger people, did not retreat from making fun of Trump. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that going forward in the days and weeks and months to come. For example, one of the chants was, and this was led by a group of young women that I was following for a while, maybe college age at most, probably late high school, and they were shouting out and getting thousands of people to call in response with them. And the one that they had was, how'd it go? He's orange. He's gross. He lost the popular vote. He's orange. He's gross. He lost the popular vote. And, of course, people were guffawing and laughing. And I walked for a while with a couple of people who had a banner, big, big banner, that thousands of people were reacting to, and the banner had a caricature cartoon picture of Trump, and then it said, "Just say no to the groper-in-chief." And people saw this, and thousands of people, and there were countless examples of this. So I think that that is going to happen. I think people can have at least they have an instinctive sense, I imagine, that it really gets under Donald Trump's skin. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that going forward. I think part of it was finally that this was a rally that began out of and was at least titularly celebrating women's rights and women standing up. And I think that had a sense that was partly to do with the greater sense of artistic and humor and outfrontedness, just wearing pink hats. I mean, that's a pretty funny thing to do right there. So I think that that's hopefully that is going to continue. And that was also the final very striking message coming out of that rally. These people are not going away. They are coming back. They will keep coming back as long as they have to come back to make their point. And I think if I were the people inside the White House now, I would be paying attention to this.
Yeah, interesting. I know that Trump, made, as far as I know, has made almost no comment. He tweeted a couple of times, first one derogatory, the second one respectful. Someone got to him, but has not, has not reckoned with, as you say, Mark, probably the largest day of political protest in the history of the country one day into his administration.
But Terrence, also, let's be honest, he's not being forced to reckon with that by the media. The media is not calling this the biggest political demonstration in U.S. history. They are missing the story here. They were still covering an Inside the Beltway story yesterday about Trump in a tiff with the CIA. That was not the story, guys and gals, my fellow colleagues in the American media. You just witnessed the biggest day of political demonstration in our history, and they managed to miss that story.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. So as you say, he's not being pushed to that. This I think will come. Let me turn again. Speaking of the media, I picked out one story in today's L.A. Times by Kathleen Decker. She had the lead article on it, and about she talks about the size. She quotes some of the people and so on, and then she says this, and I'm going to read it, and I'm going to ask you folks to work with me to answer her questions. She quotes Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. This is the moment of the beginning of the revival of the women's movement. Now, let me say, I would say that to me it felt like, and certainly it's my hope and my intention, that not just the women's movement, but the people's movement, that this is the rebirth of people's action, that my experience yesterday led me to feel that when I saw in what numbers we came out across the country, that we'd been like a rubber band that has been stretched and stretched and stretched. And once it's released, it goes further than it started. In other words, I sense, and this is certainly my hope and my intention, that we will not just resist the actions of Trump and his administration. We will go way beyond that. That we will look back at January 21st, 2017, as the beginning of a movement that took us well beyond the status quo and finally took us toward the kinds of actions and policies that we all believe America deserves, whether it's in terms of health care or climate change or education or justice or, across the board, that actually they pushed us to the wall and we're coming back, and they're going to be overwhelmed as the year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 go from here. But what did Kathleen Decker in the LA Times, she said in response to the senator's comment, she said, but is it? Despite the turnout, questions remain. Will protesters unified against Trump in the wake of divisive campaigns stay together or splinter? Will the already unpopular president change in any substantial way as a result of protests, or will he dig in? And will protests accrue to his benefit or his detriment among Americans who've not already picked a side in the fight? So that first one, I'll give you my take and ask yours. Will protesters unified against Trump in the wake of a divisive campaign stay together or splinter? I predict stay together. Sure, there are many issues, but there is a unifying common enemy. There is a unifying force that we are against, and one can see sort of how the principles and values cut across the negative, and thus, I believe, also cut across the positive. Anyone's thoughts? Who wants to go first?
Yeah. Well, I guess this is Richard.
Richard?
And I guess I would say, you know, a couple things. One is I tend to be optimistic like you are. I think implicit in Senator Gillibrand's statement it echoes a little bit, we just got through a year of kind of bitter fighting between more traditional Democrats and the new left wing of the Democratic Party, you know, catalyzed by my old boss Bernie, and it resonated a little bit with this notion of identity politics versus economics, and that was one of my concerns about the demonstration, was how is that going to play out. I would say that these marches were distinctly woman-led and woman-organized and driven by women's energy, but they were not restricted to identity. They would have been more recognizable to the great civil rights leaders of the past, like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others, who understood that equality of any one group is indivisible from economic equality, and justice for any one group is indivisible from economic justice. Any of those great leaders would have told you that. So I was enormously heartened by the fact that it did not have, for example, a policy agenda, although there were clearly, you know, it was a clear consensus about raising the minimum wage and about closing the gender gap in pay and a number of other things. It was really about, again, building a community, building a consensus going forward. And I think that provided that this movement can catalyze action, political and issue, electoral and issue oriented in the future, I think this was a perfect time to affirm the sense of community and not get down into that level of specificity. So that fact gave me a lot of hope.
Yeah, so at least from the start, it seems we're not heading towards splintering because we're starting so broadly. Drew or Mark, on the question of will they be able to remain unified?
I'll just quickly say, I think it will remain unified. I agree that I think not having a 10-point policy platform right now is perfectly appropriate. And I think it will stay unified. I think the question is, what does it mean to stay unified? What are the effective structures of action to actually create, you know, policy and social changes and to reach political goals? How will that be achieved? And what will be the organizations, the networks, the structures of action that can channel this massive energy? But I do think it will stay unified, if for no other reason than the outrages from the Trump administration will continue.
To feed it, yes, exactly. And Mark did chime in. He believes we will also stay unified. Her second question, will the already unpopular president change in any substantial way as a result of protests or dig in? Again, let me give my hit. I tend to think that if Trump were going to change in any substantial way from anything, we'd have seen hints of it by now. What we see is if one could ever point to a change, it's that he will change his rhetoric occasionally when he's overreached and overstepped. But ultimately, he returns to who he is. I don't see him changing. However, what I do hope for is that while on election night, I thought, oh, my God, Donald Trump, with a Republican Senate and a Republican House and a Democratic Party that has shown itself unwilling to meet force with force, always, it seems to me, or in almost always, being more interested in decorum and tradition and perception than in actually taking on the right and its ways of operating. That was the most discouraging thing to me, that no matter what we could do by 2018 or 2020, that they could do enormous damage. I wonder now if Americans, that majority of Americans that didn't vote for Trump, that's a vast majority since the turnout was low and his vote was in the minority. But now buttressed by people willing to say, I'm here, I'm willing to stand, that maybe we can give the Democrats, maybe it will give the Democrats some nerve and some spine, and maybe it will turn even some Republicans a few here and a few there, to make things less horrible. Let me start with you, Mark.
I think that Donald Trump does not change, but Donald Trump's reactions can change. And I think that I thought, in fact, before the rally, that Trump, because of his own volatility and inexperience at this level of government and narcissism, could very well crash and burn on his own terms. Let's remember that most of the Republican Party does not like him. They wanted anybody else but this candidate, and that's true of the congressional leadership inside the Beltway. So there's a lot of places where he could have crashed and burned already. But after Saturday, after seeing this unprecedented mass outpouring of people who are not just in opposition, but who are in his face in opposition, I think that there's nothing that Don, and laughing at him critically, ridiculing and laughing at him, nothing gets under Trump's skin more than that. People who are laughing at him, ridiculing him, not respecting him. And this is a vast number of people doing this. I think that can very well push Trump into making mistakes. And what that means, we don't know yet, but I think he was already on the way towards, making his own mistakes to crash and burn. And I think this movement of people who are not going away will push him farther in that direction. I think we'll see him making a lot of mistakes. Then the question is, can his opponents capitalize on those mistakes? I think you're right. And in fact, talking to Jamie Raskin, the congressman from Maryland, newly elected, who's one of the progressive caucus, who boycotted the inauguration ceremony along with John Lewis and many others, he and others last night after the rally were saying that this kind of outpouring of people in the streets is definitely going to send a message to Democratic office holders that they have to stand up. And if they do stand up, that the public, large portions of the public are behind them. I don't think, however, Terrence, that you're going to see Republicans responding to this. You know, let's not kid ourselves. That those rallies yesterday, that was the left.
Well, no, but let me just jump in, Mark. What I assume that tempers my belief that will happen is, of course, the gerrymandered districts, which means that it doesn't matter if a lot of the constituents in their state feel one way, they're set up safely. This doesn't apply nearly as much to the Senate as it does to the House, though. I mean, in other words, when the people are vocal and insistent and consistent, that's what I was hoping, that some of them would waver.
Well, gerrymandered districts, of course, is one of the great scandals of American politics. But even with gerrymandering, the larger factor in all of this is how many people don't bother to vote in the first place. And if you have not just people in the streets, but what I also saw here in Washington, young people going around with these organizers who are actively trying to recruit candidates to run in state and local and congressional races in 2018 on Bernie Sanders-like radical tickets within the Democratic Party, and to push that agenda at the state level. You know, even in a gerrymandered district, if you are able to turn out enough people, you can change things. And believe me, nothing gets either party's representatives, sitting representatives inside of the Capitol building, nothing gets their attention more than to see this many people out in the streets, because they know what it can lead to. That shows them that this is an organized political force, and an organized political force can come into their district and vote them out of office if they're not careful.
I mean, they can just look at what happened with the Tea Party for the Republicans in the other side. It took out a lot of establishment folks and led to success. Hopefully the same thing happens here. Drew or Richard, do we expect any change in Trump?
Well, you know, Trump is actually, I agree that he won't change. This is Richard, by the way.
Yeah.
I agree that he is unlikely, he's not going to change as an entity. He is what he is. He seems very volatile in certain ways, and he seems desperate to be pleased, to be pleasing to other people. I remain deeply concerned about just what you guys have been talking about, the gerrymandered extreme radical right Republican Party that surrounds him. I mean, where Trump varies from the Republican Party, it's usually, at least rhetorically, for the better in terms of trade deals or infrastructure or whatever. They're pretty much going to hem him in from, even if he did change. I think they would prevent him from taking any whimsical action and attempt to please people. So I think we may run the risk at times of overemphasizing his power and forgetting just how dangerous Mike Pence and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are in all of this. But I do also agree with the statement that elected officials respond very strongly to calls, to contacts, to the possibility of being primary, to all of those things. So I think this new wave of electoral activism and potential candidates, along with, you know, Michael Moore's urging people to make calls, I think that's going to make a difference, especially on the Democratic side. And then who knows, maybe if we can get Democratic candidates for state houses who have something to tell voters that might interest them, the day may actually come when, maybe not in our lifetimes, but someday, where they can actually undo some of that gerrymandering. So it's a long process that we just saw beginning on Saturday.
Right. Drew?
Yeah, I agree. Trump won't change, but I think we're still getting a handle on what Donald Trump as a presidential administration even means. And so it's not clear, is he going to be listening to Paul Ryan, or is he going to be listening to Steve Bannon? Is
right.
he listening to General Mattis, or is he going to be listening to General Flynn?
Yep.
And so I think this is a whole very complex, complicated mixed bag. I love what Mark said about how, you know, his erraticness and his need to be loved can cause him to make mistakes. You know, and so I think he does. He's fundamentally erratic. And so one minute he's saying health care for everybody, the next minute, you know, he's attacking a business or could be starting a war. So it's a very dangerous situation. I think we have to operate on two tracks, which is one, that Trump may be forced, something may come up. There's more, probably more than enough that could force him to resign in some kind of normal universe, and that could come out any day. And we need to keep pressuring and keep calling for a real investigation and keep encouraging whistleblowers and leakers and people that have information, et cetera, et cetera. On the other track, though, I think we have to be prepared for the idea that the Republicans will do nothing to put them in check in terms of impeachment proceedings. There may be, we may need to elect a Democratic House of Representatives to introduce articles of impeachment and a Democratic Senate to remove them from office, and that there will be no, you know, real accountability for Trump until that happens. But it's also not clear how much of this agenda he's going to get through and whether Paul Ryan's really going to be pulling the strings and calling the shots. I totally agree with you on the there's a, what I call a ruthlessness gap between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. There's a ruthlessness gap. And I'm not encouraging Democrats to imitate Republicans exactly, but if they don't start understanding this ruthlessness gap, understanding what kind of fight they're in, they're going to keep getting rolled. And, you know, the Merrick Garland appointment, stealing President Obama's Supreme Court appointment, is a perfect example of this. So I think we need a lot of pressure, both inside and outside. And the street pressure builds the spine of the Democrats. It builds the political pressure. And we need to keep pushing on all levels.
There was an op-ed by three of the folks behind the group Indivisible that some of you, or all of you, may have seen, which said the Democrats have to act more like the Tea Party and have to look to that as a model. And I think, yes, differences there will be, but I think that model of insurrection, in a way, from outside the Beltway, leading to change within the Beltway. One of Obama's last bits of counsel, I forget whether it was in his press conference or his farewell speech, was get a clipboard. And what he meant was get a clipboard, start collecting signatures, run for the local school board, run for the local council. This is the way it happens. Also, where 2010, I think, was the most critical, perhaps the most critical error in the Obama administration, not channeling the enthusiasm of 2008 into an activist movement to win the 2010 midterms, or even to vote in the 2010 midterms, cost us so much in terms of the redistricting. Now 2018 is a chance to change that, so that in 2020 the shoe is on the other foot, and it, hopefully Democrats with spines actually in the driver's seat instead of Republicans with Tea Party leanings. Something that I mentioned earlier, and it's something that's been rolling around in my head for a while. I mentioned it in that previous live show I did a couple of weeks ago, but I would love to get your response to it. And it's this notion that I've been thinking about actually for a couple of years of 60s 2.0. When I first started thinking about it, I was noticing that young people were not nearly so into consumption as the American corporate structure hoped they would be. They were not nearly so needing to get a car, needing to buy a home, needing to throw their life balance out of whack in pursuit of financial gain. Not to say that there aren't some of them who are young tech billionaires, but that there's a culture that seems to bring back some of the values of the 60s. And then you add to that the move for LGBTQ justice, black and racial justice, et cetera, et cetera. Just a real sharing of the values. But the difference being having the technology now to actually make a sharing economy work. Not, again, that there's some, that there aren't things we've got to do about the sharing economy so that it doesn't just become a billionaire builder where we're all serfs and our sharing is making billionaires while we get nothing, but that there is this notion that the technology allows you not to buy a car, not to use as much fossil fuel, not to be as much of a consumer, et cetera, to work in a way that might have more balance. And then the second thing that's different is that when the young people of the 60s said, we have a new vision, we have new values, we want a new society, whether it's civil rights or anti-war or the environment or women's rights, et cetera, there was very little support from previous generations. In this case, there are those who were the originals, 60s generation, and there were all those in the generations in between that actually hold similar values. And it seems to me a cross-generational, cross-issue movement for these values that are more values of community, more values of meaning, more values of justice, more values of environmental, of living in tune with nature, has a possibility. And I felt that this vision made sense before the election, and now I began to think was necessary. And then after Saturday, I think maybe possible. And it would be the best of the 60s, plus technology and social media, plus older generations in partnership with younger generations. And this time, these values win. This goes back to that thing I said before of the rubber band going in its response further than it was pushed. Is it time for a national movement that brings together individuals and organizations, as I said, across issues, geography, generations, color, and class, organized perhaps around a vision at least, but perhaps a handful of declared goals, and dedicated to supporting each other with funding from those who have it, with strategy from those who have experience, with wisdom from those who've been around, with tech savvy from those who have that, with street actions from those who are willing to do that. And as of Saturday, we know there's lots more than we thought. Do any of you, or I'd love to hear from each of you, on whether you think this is just an observation or whether there's something of value in utilizing this perspective. Richard, you're the one that goes the closest back to that that original generation. What's your thought?
Well, you know, one of the quotes that struck me in this campaign this year was when Hillary Clinton met with some Black Lives Matter protesters and said to them, "I don't believe you change hearts, you change laws." And I think that's the old mindset, frankly. I think if you look back at the history of Black Lives Matter, and by the way, I was there when they first demonstrated against Bernie. You know, I've seen both sides of that sort. I think there's no question that Black Lives Matter, by changing hearts, will have an enormous impact in the changing of laws. I think that it's backwards to think that the laws get changed first. I think in that sense, A, I agree with you that a movement built around values and ideals is the grounding place and the generative source of this kind of political change. So I agree with that. And I do think there is something of a through line there. I think the real hope is the millennials. Now, to a certain extent, we know they're not buying homes or cars at the rate their predecessors did because they're saddled with enormous amounts of student debt. They've graduated or entered a terrible job market that's getting marginally better, but it's still tough at the entry level or tougher than it was. So, I think there are some restrictive reasons for that. But I think at the same time, their social values are enormously advanced. You know, one of the young millennial age Christian fundamentalist preachers, I think he's the son of Tammy Faye and Jim Baker, basically has to avoid the issue of whether it's wrong to be gay and those sorts of things because even young Christian fundamentalists aren't having it anymore. So there is a tremendous wave of social change and belief in the equality of all, regardless of gender, orientation, race. And if you look at the polls, there's also tremendous openness towards economic equality and economic progressivism and socialism and so on. So I do think there's tremendous hope in both of those things. But I think it comes back to the notion. I guess I would conclude by saying, I think your vision or some variation of it is definitely possible. My only qualifier would be, I think it has to be generated by the movement itself.
Exactly.
So we may not be able to predict what it is. They'll come up with it, and they'll tell the rest of us.
Very good. Mark, and then Drew.
I think that that movement is already here. That movement is what you saw on the streets on Saturday. And it has been forming for some time. You could see parts of it, as you mentioned, in Black Lives Matter. You could certainly see it in the Bernie Sanders rallies. That movement is now in the streets. And it is, I think, one of the things that happened yesterday was that people saw just how big it is, how big that movement is, and how fierce and ferocious it's going to be. I don't think... I wish that there were someone in this conversation who was under 40 or under 30 talking about it. And I also have to say I wish there were a woman in this conversation. I know, Terrence, I want to quickly say I know you tried to book someone onto the show,
right,
and couldn't. But I think it's very important to hear those voices. But I will say that in my reporting and talking to those kinds of people, they don't necessarily like to hear the 1960s invoked yet again and again and again by the grizzled old veterans.
Yep.
Well, Sonny, if you just do it the way we did it.
Yeah.
You know?
They're
in their own way.
Yeah.
They know that history. They're inspired by that history, but they also are making their own history. And I think that could not be more fabulous.
Very good. And Drew, and you can actually tell us your age, because I think you might fall within one of the categories, Mark.
I'm well over 40. I'm in my late 40s here.
No offense. No offense.
No, none taken. Yeah, I mean, I agree, obviously. It would be great to have a woman on the panel. Terrence mentioned that, and that's part of what's different from the 60s is that we see that these new emerging movements are women-led, are youth-led, are black-led, are indigenous-led, are queer-led, et cetera. I'm a student of the 60s myself, so I do agree with what Mark said in terms of it can feel a little old to a new generation of activists, but I think the idea and the concept of 60s 2.0 is important and is crucial, because during the 60s it was a radical period of democratization. It was a period, you know, from the 50s to the 60s in which the civil rights movement in 11 years fundamentally transformed the apartheid state of the southern United States. And so anyone who cares about a world of justice and ecology would be foolish not to try to build on the momentum of our current time and of the momentum of what we saw yesterday. So absolutely. I mean, toward the end of his life, Dr. King was saying we have to planetize the movement. And he said, you know, of course, it's obvious that our movements must intersect because of the interrelated nature of the issues we face. But he said, so far we haven't even begun to build the skills and the strategy to planetize our movement for social justice. And so if we take this challenge, really, that King was giving to us some 50 years ago, how do we planetize the movement in our time? I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be the values and the vision and the ideals of humanitarianism, justice, self-determination, ecology, compassion, siblinghood, but it's also going to be the technologies that you're talking about. So, yeah, I think that's why I've named my organization Planetize the Movement, because I think this is the challenge. And the way that I say it and have been saying it for 20 years is that we have to build a movement that connects ecology, social justice, and cosmology or worldview. And we need to build that movement using the power of dream, the power of story, the power of art, and the power of action. So, yeah, my hope for you, I mean, what you say, this may be an observation, it may be a hope, but it's a hope and an observation upon which the entire future depends. With the climate crisis, the mass extinction crisis, the immense poverty and brutality, war, violence, and injustice and oppression, we're either going to have a movement like that or we're not going to have a very satisfying future.
Very good. Thank you, Drew. So we're going to wrap it here. I can see that I want to continue these conversations. What do we hope for in terms of next steps is obviously another conversation. What structures, what organizations are going to take place? How is this going to generate? All those things have to be answered. but that'll be for another time. Websites in which you can learn more about some of my guests are drewdellinger.org. That's DrewDellinger, drewdellinger.org, and markhertsgard.com. That's MarkHertsgard, markhertsgard.com. My own is terrencemcnally.net. Thank you to Drew Dellinger, Richard R.J. Esko, and Mark Hertzgard. Keep up your good work. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcnally, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, TemcnallyatMac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on iTunes. Finally, thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely, and I look forward to being with you again soon.